Iran and the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal meet in Vienna for a new round of talks on reviving the international accord. A convoy of U.S. military troops comes under attack in southern Iraq. France threatens reprisals in the financial services sector if a deal agreed between the EU and Britain over post-Brexit fishing rights is not implemented. Greetings and a warm welcome to World News. Good to have you with us. Now, beginning with our top story, Iran and the remaining parties to the 2015 nuclear agreement have held fresh negotiations in Vienna. That's aimed at reviving the embattled accord. Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi led the Iranian delegation in discussions with France, Germany, Britain, Russia, and China. This is the third round of talks since diplomatic efforts to salvage a deal began in early April. Speaking after a latest session, the Chinese envoy said that there has been significant progress in the talks, but major differences still remain. He stressed that the U.S. must remove its sanctions against Iran before Tehran returns to its compliance with the nuclear agreement.
We believe it is the U.S. previous administration who first pulled out from the JCPOA. So it's just axiomatic that U.S. should abolish all its unilateral sanctions against Iran, as well as any third party in the first place, before Iran moved to implement the provisions on the JCPOA accordingly. So this is a fundamental issue involving rights versus wrong.
The official expressed hope that all parties could sustain the momentum already reached in order to settle the issues. The U.S. unilateral left the nuclear agreement in 2018 and imposed sanctions on Iran. Tehran began scaling back its commitments under the deal a year later in the face of the failure of other sides to ensure its benefits. Now, Tehran saying it will only reverse the commitment cuts once it verifies the removal of all sanctions imposed in the wake of the U.S. pullout. Tehran has also warned it will not continue talks if they become protracted. Let's go to Vienna, to the venue of these talks. We're just mentioning Huma Lezgi is there, and she's been there for quite some time. Huma, what do you have for us? What's the latest?
Okay, Behzad, we just had an interview with Iran's lead delegate, Mr. Abbas Araghchi, the deputy foreign minister who's leading the Iranian delegation here. And he did mention that ahead of the Joint Commission session, he had a meeting, one separate meeting with the Chinese and the Russians. And he said that during that meeting, it became clear that Russia and China share Iran's opinions and positions on almost all the issues that are up for discussions here. And he said he had a separate meeting with the three European countries, Britain, France and Germany, and that the various issues were discussed then. Then we had, of course, the Joint Commission session taking place between all the remaining signatories of the JCPOA, after which Mr. Araghchi said that the sides have agreed to start work on the third expert-level group. And this working group, he said, is called the Working Group on Practical Arrangements. That's how he termed it. And he said that this third working group will be working on not just the matter of sequence, meaning when the measures need to be taken both by Iran and the U.S. in order to come back to full compliance. It will also deal with the issue of verification, implementation day, and other practical arrangements that need to be made once there is a final agreement. Now, the issues here, he said, still remain. Although he said that he believes progress has been made and that the discussions are on the right track, he did also say that there are still some various important and serious challenges that need to be resolved, the most obvious one being the issue of sequence. He said that Iran's position is still the same, that it is not going to implement its measures, come back to full compliance before the U.S. has removed all the sanctions. And Iran has verified that removal. And he also said that obviously this is something that there are differences on, because we know the U.S. has said that it is also not going to do that. And it has also called for a compliance approach, something Iran rejects. And also, so this is one of the important issues, and also one of the important differences is the sanctions. So Mr. Araghchi, when I asked him what sanctions the U.S. is willing to lift, which sanctions the U.S. is not willing to lift, and if that's going to be a major problem or not, he did say that Iran is still saying that it wants all of the sanctions removed. These include the sanctions that are part of the JCPOA and are JCPOA-related and need to be removed, and also the sanctions that have been introduced by the Trump administration. So he said basically all the sanctions that have been imposed under Trump after the Trump administration withdrew from the JCPOA in 2018. Right. So these are not just the JCPOA-related sanctions. These are sanctions that have been imposed on Iran under other labels like terrorism, human rights, etc., but do affect Iran's economy and the practical return to the JCPOA. So right now, he said that the sides are going to continue their negotiations. Immediately, the expert groups, he said, are going to continue their work, and the political directors are going to monitor that work and facilitate that process. We might see maybe within days another joint commission session, and then see where the sides will go from that stage on.
Okay, appreciate that. Update on Maliski from Vienna. Now, a convoy of U.S. forces has reportedly come under attack in southern Iraq. Two improvised explosive devices went off on the route of the convoy in Diyarbakir province, that according to a security source. The two IEDs exploded remotely. The blast reportedly inflicted damage to one of the U.S. vehicles, which was carrying military equipment. Attacks on U.S. forces and their supply convoys in Iraq have risen in the past month as anti-American sentiments running high. The sentiments grew after the U.S. assassinated a top Iranian general and a senior Iraqi commander near Baghdad in January last year. A prominent international rights group says that Israel's persecution of Palestinians amounts to crimes against humanity and crimes of apartheid. Human Rights Watch says examples of the Israeli apartheid policies are the restrictions on Palestinians' movement, the seizure of their land for illegal settlements as well. The rights group has called on the International Criminal Court to investigate and prosecute Israeli officials over the persecution of the Palestinians. Several weeks ago, the court said it would investigate war crimes against the Israeli military in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Mona Kendall in the occupied West Bank has provided us with some details about the latest report by Human Rights Watch.
They are accusing the Israeli authorities that they are allowing the Jewish settlers over Palestinians across the occupied territories. We are speaking about the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and even they are speaking about the besieged Gaza Strip. The aim is combined with the systematic oppression of the Palestinians and inhumane acts committed against them, which Human Rights Watch says taken together constitute the crime of apartheid. Let's elaborate what's the meaning of apartheid. According to the international law, it's deemed as a crime against humanity by the Rome Statute, which established the International Criminal Court. The definition has many elements, mainly maintaining a group of people, domination by one racial group over another. So then, according to all the agreements, Palestinians must get these lands in order to establish their future Palestinian state. However, the Israeli authorities had brought those Jewish settlers to the mountains of the West Bank and in East Jerusalem. Al-Quds, they continue to attack Palestinians, assault them, seize their lands, ruin their properties. Every day, the Israeli authorities approve numerous laws against the law in order to protect and defend the Israeli settlers over the Palestinians while committing more crimes against the Palestinian people.
Russia has accused the U.S. and its NATO allies in Europe of contributing to an increased military threat in the region with their actions.
The growth of military threat is fueled by the activities of the United States and NATO in the European region. They increase the combat readiness of troops and strengthen their presence.
The Russian Defense Minister criticized NATO for deploying its modern military infrastructure and carrying out operational combat training in Europe. Shoigu also warned that nationalistic sentiments being fueled in Ukraine could further provoke military conflict in the Donbas region. He said that Moscow will act if it realizes necessary to ensure security at its borders. Tensions have run high between Russia and NATO countries following Moscow's military buildup along the border with Ukraine earlier this month. And that, of course, after reports of renewed clashes between Ukrainian troops and pro-Russia forces in Donbass. Ukraine, the U.S., and NATO accuse Moscow of propping up militia in eastern Ukraine, and that's what Moscow denies. Time now for the news review section. The European Parliament is set to ratify the post-Brexit trade deal between the bloc and the UK, and that's amid tensions, including a French threat of reprisals against Britain. According to reports, MEPs would approve the trade and cooperation agreement that has been operating provisionally since the UK officially left the EU in January. It covers trade in goods that can be free of tariffs or quotas. However, the vote comes amid multiple feuds over the UK's implementation of Brexit agreements. France accused the UK of blocking fishing rights, warning it would hold up approvals for British financial service operators to work in the EU. There are also tensions over the UK's unilateral decision to ease trading rules for Northern Ireland. Since Brexit, there has been some disruption to trade as Northern Ireland remains part of the EU's single market. Okay, let's see what's going on there. So we'll have a couple of our correspondents, people watching all these in Europe. We'll have our Kristen Honda from Paris and also Amina Taylor in our London bureau. Good to have both of you on the show. Now let's go to Paris first. Chris, what's this problem between France and the UK? Walk us through that and different aspects of it.
Well, it's a complicated agreement, this Brexit agreement. So it's like, in general, if it's implemented totally, it's favorable for France on the fishing, and it's favorable for the UK on the financial services. Now, France says it will only vote in favor of the full implementation of this agreement if the UK commits to its commitments. So it means the problem with the fishery thing is the French fisher boats should have authorization to fish in the UK waters because there is a lack of fish in the French area. So, and they say that only very few boats received the license of the UK to fish in the British waters. So they threaten to take reprisal sanctions against UK on the financial services. What does that mean? When the United Kingdom was part of the European Union, there was free traffic of goods. It means no limitations on goods coming in the European Union out from the UK. Now, if the UK goes out of the European Union, it means that there will be quality checks on goods, and there might be taxes to be paid on the goods if it comes in from the UK to the European Union. So the UK negotiated a favorable agreement on this issue, but France is threatening the UK if the UK does not respect the agreement on the fishing, then France will take reprisals on the financial services.
Okay. Now turning to London, Amina, good to have you with us. Hopefully you're safe from this COVID pandemic. There's the Indian version that's worse than what you're facing there in the UK. Now, regarding this UK's implementation of Brexit agreements, that seems to be the problem. Tell us about that and also the state of the UK fishing after the Brexit.
Well, let's clarify something Chris mentioned there, that whilst goods, as in physical goods, are covered by this agreement, the TCA, services and what that means for the service sector, banking, finance, student exchange, that kind of thing, that hasn't been fully covered yet. So the French are saying, listen, we could use a good faith agreement and go ahead here, or we can actually implement things to the letter of the law. Now, let me just take you back to the fact that MEPs were so unhappy with the way the UK had behaved here by unilaterally kind of renegotiating one of the most serious aspects of Brexit, that they'd waited until now to actually ratify the deal, so kind of taking things to as much of an impasse as they could. And there's so many loose ends that still remain about this. We do know that, as you mentioned there, the Northern Ireland Protocol is still problematic, where goods and services out of Northern Ireland and into Northern Ireland still classify technically as a part of Europe's single market. That hasn't been sorted. We know the simmering tensions that is causing in the north of Ireland. And it's essentially, as members of the European Union have mentioned, it's a lose-lose situation for everyone. Mm-hmm. There are still heads being scratched about how comes we're here in the first place. No one can yet convince a great part of this population that this was a wise deal, unfortunately.
Right. And I mean, why did it take so long for this ratification, I mean, to take place? And what difference would it make, I mean, once it's ratified?
Well, MEPs were angry. There you are, you'd negotiated a deal after four hard years. We have spoken many times here about the to-ing and fro-ing, about what British negotiators want, what Michel Barnier, who was and still remains the man helming the EU's response here, and those tensions. And then after everything was signed, said and done, Britain decided that actually we wanted some other bits sorted out that we're not a part of. These negotiations. So Europe took this personally. You know, Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the Commission here, said Europe might have to show some real teeth here, and I think we may well see what that means going forward.
Okay, we'll wait and see. Thank you very much for that. Kristen Hund, our correspondent in Paris, and we had also Amina Taylor in our London bureau joining us with our contribution. And that's it for this news review. India's new daily COVID cases have stayed above 300,000 for a sixth day in a row. The country recorded 323,000 new cases in just one day, and that was below a Monday worldwide peak of 352,000. Total COVID cases now topping 17.6 million, the second largest in the world. Total deaths nearly 198,000. The virus surge in India has caused a shortage of beds and oxygen supplies. Now that has forced hospitals to turn the patients away. The army has pledged urgent medical aid to help tackle the crisis. Several countries have also promised assistance. In other news, a protest against military rule in Chad has turned violent, leaving at least two people dead and more than two dozen others injured. Protesters hit the streets of the capital of N'Djamena to denounce the army's takeover of power Followed the death of President Idriss Deby. Police fired tear gas to disperse the crowd. Idriss Deby died last week during a battle with the rebel groups in the country's north. The military saying it will hand over power to an elected government. It also named Deby's son as interim president before an election is held in 18 months. Several opposition politicians have called the move a coup d'etat and urged the people to take to the streets. Anti-French sentiment is also running high in the country, demonstrators blaming Paris for backing the Deby regime against the will of the people. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Ramadan is here. Allah's mercy is near. Time to give, time to share, time to show we care. Cause Ramadan is here. Whoa, Ramadan is here. Today's lesson. Prayers in the month of Ramadan. Now, in spite of all these du'as, supplications, and prayers, we stood before Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in benediction and supplication and opened our tongues to utter words with Him. But if our heart was occupied in some other things, our mind and self kept thinking about other affairs, and more often about things which Allah regard as His enemy, remaining amused in those thoughts to the extent that even forgetting the words uttered to Him, becoming completely naive as to with whom are we talking to and what is being sought, what is going to be the result of such ignorance and negligence? Brothers and sisters, when we pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, we have to know what we are asking for. We have to know the translations of these du'as and supplications, and we have to make sure that the state of our heart, our conscience, our spirit is in line and is in sync with these words. If we don't do so, then we have not taken the full benefit. We have not reaped the full benefit. In this stage, wouldn't Allah proclaim, "O you poor deviated ones, didn't you feel ashamed in treating my invitation so lightly with makri? Didn't you feel ashamed by the way you talked to me that if your own servants, subordinates, and even your enemies would have treated you in this manner, you would have never excused them? Didn't you feel sorry for treating me so lightly, even lighter than your own servants? Because you will feel ashamed and would avoid to treat them in this manner. But don't feel ashamed with me, Allah. If such reprimand is issued for us from Him, would we have any reply then?"
رمضان المستبين جاء بالنور المبين رمضان 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 القانتين.
Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing our prayers, supplications in the holy and blessed month of Ramadan to invoke the blessings of Allah. And we're talking about our actions and our state of heart and our mind being in sync with those du'as. We have said that if we don't do that, we're not going to be able to reap the benefits of those du'as. Glory be to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Indeed, He possesses wonderful patience and great forbearance, that were it not for His patience, forbearance, greatness, benevolence, and kindness, what would He have done with us for such impudence? Except that He would have shown outburst of His wrath against us and would have thrown us out from His blessed threshold forever. By confining us into the most horrible and darkest chambers of hell, in most wretched and humiliating disgrace, being inflicted with hell's most severe punishments. Brothers and sisters, it is so important for our words and actions and our state of heart to be in coherence and in sync with the words we utter in the form of supplications. Yes, the majority of people in their supplications behave in such manner where their hearts are not in sync. Their heart being closed by the lock of negligence, they stand in prayer, speaking to Him with the tip of their tongue, while having their heart and soul occupied somewhere else. Even worse than this are those who apparently open their tongue for asking pardon, admitting their shortcomings, sins, transgressions, and disobedience, but inside their heart, they regard themselves as pious, righteous, and faithful servants. And whatever Allah has done with them about their destinies, they are not pleased with it. May Allah save us from among those disobedient servants of Allah.
Forgive me for everything I've done in the past.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
But you know that there will be better, there will be stronger.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Let It Fall, LA 1982 to 1992, directed by John Ridley. And joining me in the studio, we have Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. And beside him is Suresh Grover, who is the director of the Monitoring Group, which is a leading anti-racist charity here in the UK that promotes civil rights. Now, Let It Fall provides an in-depth look at the racial tensions in Los Angeles in the 10 years leading up to the 92 riots, which erupted after the acquittal of four police officers charged in the brutal beating of Rodney King. The riots caused a lot of destruction in the streets of LA, which resulted in the deaths of more than 50 people, who were mostly black, injured over 2,000, and caused at least $1 billion worth of damages.
The Los Angeles police officially reprimanded Police Chief Daryl Gates.
We were having deaths from the chokehold.
He didn't get along with the community.
In the early 80s, the street gangs started to connect with the drug dealers.
It just got out of control.
Karen Tashima was killed in gang crossfire.
This is something that you always see on the news, and this time it happened to us.
We are determined to take back the streets of Los Angeles.
Operation Hammer was a free ticket to go out there and do overly aggressive police work.
What I witnessed at the scene was 100% LAPD policy.
Soon Ja Du, found guilty of killing a 16-year-old girl, received no jail time.
She got away with murder.
Black and brown people are being beat up, shot, choked to death by police forces all over this country.
We, the jury, find the defendant not guilty.
Not? You just disrespect us like this? Like our lives don't matter?
Not guilty, the verdict for all of them.
We were sort of stunned.
We need to back out of here before we have to use deadly force.
It's like pouring gasoline and striking a match. It's not protest anymore. Now it's a full-blown riot.
I was a part of a movement, a black movement. There's a Florence and Normandy in every city and every state.
It was just one of those days compassion wasn't handed out to other races.
God told me to go save them, save that man's life.
You talked about guerrilla warfare, and it's right here.
18-year-old Edward Song Lee was shot to death.
That doesn't seem real.
It felt like it couldn't be happening to us.
I know the anger, and I know exactly what my people are feeling.
We've lost the city. It's gone.
I want to know why God let this happen.
Unity, empowerment, they're not just cliches. We have to get ourselves together.
Thank you very much for coming on the show. Very much welcome here. And when you watch this documentary, you feel an overwhelming sense of injustice against black people in the US. And another thing that's striking about this documentary is that it's an oral history as told through many different perspectives and angles, through police officers, jurors, and a whole host of others, the victims and families of the victims. And Lee, if I can start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
I think you've sort of identified what makes it unique and what makes it particularly probing is it's an inside story. So the filmmakers, they don't go to pundits and people from the outside. Every single person you hear from was within the story. They're part of the story, whether they're perpetrators or victims or police or, you know, lost loved ones. And that and keeping to that very tight focus, I think, really, I mean, obviously up to the emotional side of the stories because people are talking about their direct personal involvement, but it gives you that unique perspective because we're not trying to hear from, you know, professors and cultural critics outside it. We stay very much within the story, and I think that's a really great move. The other thing that's great is he doesn't identify who's who. So you start hearing from people, you might then find that they were a policeman who was, you know, inflicted some violence, or, you know, an African American who was involved in, you know, hurting a white American. And by doing that and saving the sort of the revelation, you get to just hear who these people are before otherwise you might just immediately identify them as, oh, racist police officer, mm-hmm. or, you know, violent African American. And of course what you're hearing is a more sort of multifaceted side to each of these stories, and I think that's a real strength in the film.
That is indeed a great strength, and you hear their personal stories, and I enjoyed that progression, and you feel a connection to all these characters. And Suresh, if I could turn to you, what was your take on Let It Fall?
I think it's a rich history, almost a forensic examination of a decade before the so-called uprisings. I wouldn't call it a riot. I use the word uprising, and there's a reason for it. And I think it tries to focus on what took place what incidents took place which led to the build-up of the riots, which is very important. The context is very, very important. And even in this country, when there are public disturbances taking place, people only look at one trigger moment that started the stuff, rather than the history of relationship between the black communities and the police, for example.
So you're saying this the context, this build-up is
very important.
The
context is absolutely critical. I mean, you know, the police commissioner's views about baton charges, metal baton charges, choke holes, and he tries to describe black people not suffering as much as the white people in terms of that. It's just sheer racism, in my view. It unmasks the real relationship between the authorities and people who live in the area, who took part in it and who survived in it.
Of course, LA was a very iconic city, it still is, but particularly at that time because of the Olympics, and they even had their first black mayor. So who would know, and underneath the surface, that all this racial tensions was bubbling?
Well, I think what he's trying to point out is that it's enmasked it, but actually people who live in it know exactly what's happening, including the police office and the mayor and the police commissioner. So although the story in cinematic terms is being told through different eyes, what is clear is that the bubble and the bubbling and the simmering and of dissent and the relationship souring between different authorities is actually very, very open and pertinent, and people are turning a blind eye to it. For example, you know, the chokehold is being criticized by everyone. It's actually made illegal. So what do the police do? Instead of decreasing their powers, they increase their powers by using a metal baton. And they use both taser and, I mean, youth.
And I'll have to pause you there. We'll go into that a bit more detail later on.
One of the many issues that came up during his time as the chief was the chokehold. It was a controversy for a long, long time in the media.
The Los Angeles Police Commission late today officially reprimanded Police Chief Darrell Gates for comments he made last month about black people and a police restraint method.
Chief Gates said, in some blacks, when it is applied, the veins or arteries do not open up as fast as they do in normal people.
That's asinine. That's insanity. That I still to this day can't believe someone said that. And, of course, that raised a firestorm.
There is a direct parallel between the disproportionate killing of black people in this city and the irresponsible remarks of the chief of police.
There was truly shocking comments made by the LAPD police chief at the time, Darrell Gates. And of course, we learn a bit later on in the documentary that he refused to apologize for those comments. And he gave a sort of apology for people being offended, which is hardly an apology. Lee, what was your reactions watching those comments being made?
Well, I mean, they're horrific. And Darrell Gates, I mean, this area and this time in American history and leading up to the riots, there's been a number of films made on this in the last few years. And so the film goes over, you know, if you're familiar with those films, a lot of familiar ground. So Darrell Gates has been vilified, very rightly so, a lot of the time. What's very interesting about this film is there's a section towards the end where they show that his son himself was addicted to drugs. And it's not letting him off the hook in any shape or form, but it's giving you another side to this person who's very easy otherwise to just demonize as, you know, the big bad guy. And don't get me wrong, his policies and his, you know, his stance you can't justify it in any way. But what's really interesting about the film is it tries to sort of look at people from different angles and maybe give facets of them you didn't know about without excusing it. But, you know, you go, okay, well, then this guy has some other issues going on at the time. Now, again,
it's a very complex story, but
it's really trying to look at things from a wider angle than you maybe have seen in the past.
And, Suresh, would you agree with what Lee said just there? What did you make of these comments being made?
Life is complicated. People are very complicated. I've been in riots in Southall in the 70s, and I know people are complicated. But to justify, I'm not saying Lee is justifying, I don't want to give an air of justification. To me, the comment about the chokehold and not apology was sheer racism, and there's no excuse for it. He's a senior police officer. He's a senior police officer who should be held accountable for his comments and his practices and procedures. Mm-hmm. Yes, he's a human being, but we are beyond that in that environment. So when I live in areas like South, which is where I come from, which has had riots, I expect police officers to be totally professional. What I don't expect them to do is to blame the victim or the communities that are victimized by police officers because of their racism And it's happened not just to black people, too. I mean, I did a case of Blair Peach, who was killed by the SPG in 1979. You know what the police said? He had a thin cranium, that's why he died. Mm-hmm. And they used the lead gauze baton to kill him in 1979. Mm-hmm. In Mark Durgan's case, what did they say? Honest but mistaken belief. So there's a justification that takes place perpetually by the mainstream and politicians. I do not want to excuse that. Yeah. That doesn't mean, cinematically, people can't look at the complicated picture and come to a resolution. But our society is divided between people who have power and who don't have power.
That's
really important to look at.
And Lee, I want to ask you, in picking up on your point, do you think Ridley was sympathetic in any way to the riots through this film? Do you get the idea that the police are in fact the problem, that the riots or uprisings didn't happen out of a vacuum, that people just became crazy one day?
No, I mean, the whole 10-year time frame, as Suresh has noted, it gives you the context and it gives you a lot of understanding of why tensions within the communities and between the police and not just the African-American community, the Korean-American community, Japanese-American, it's a very, you know, diverse picture that this film paints. I think Ridley is very... he's an interesting figure because he's kind of known as a bit of a polemicist. Mm-hmm. You know, he wrote a very controversial piece for a magazine about 10 years ago using the N-word and criticizing his own community, mm-hmm. you know, with 12 Years a Slave, which he wrote the screenplay for.
Yeah,
him and the director had a big falling out. And I was surprised, actually, at how much empathy this shows. It's not his usual kind of... you know, mode of speaking, if you like. He's very much into controversy usually and stirring things up, and I felt that this was a much more restrained and, you know, trying to be more empathetic to look at it. He doesn't let anybody off the hook. So as I said, you don't identify some of the people speaking, and then you find that actually some of these guys were the guys who dragged the white truck driver out of the van and you know, nearly killed him. Mm-hmm. Similarly with the police, you see some people making some very, you know, reasonable statements, and you find out they're absolutely part of the endemic racism of the LA police force. So I was very interested at getting that sort of, you know, empathetic thing, and again, without letting anybody off the hook, and, you know, there is clear racism going on there without any shadow of it.
Well, of course, and it's interesting that so many interpretations can come out of this, and I guess that's a testament to the documentary. And Lee, as we heard in the documentary, one of the police officers in charge at the time told his police officers to avoid that area. Mm. Were they effectively then abandoning their duty to protect and serve?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm certainly no expert on police tactics and what you should and shouldn't do, but there was a very clear, you know, decision taken to pull out, and obviously that creates a vacuum, and that allows a lot more things potentially to go on that maybe would be restricted if there was a police presence there. But I mean, this is just part of the chaos. I mean, what it does, it really gives you a picture of the absolute chaos that happened within those 2 days. I was actually in LA probably a couple of weeks after these events, and I was actually walking around through South Central LA. I'd never been in a sort of supposedly peaceful community that had such an air of foreboding and tension. And so it was still, you know, just absolutely in the air, really, really unnerving. So I can only imagine what it would have been like on the 2 days in question. Again, that's no excuse not to get the police in there, because that effectively is their job, to try and maintain, you know, some sort of, you know, so that things don't just descend into utter chaos. It obviously had a huge impact on the events of those 2 days.
And Suresh, why didn't the police go to the area? Were you surprised by their reaction? Were they intimidated by the riots?
I wasn't surprised at all by the reaction. It's a very common police practice in a public disturbance to leave an area on its own. You know, public disturbances and riots raise a number of issues, and one of them is, why is it that law-abiding citizens living in that area destroy their town?
But they have genuine grievances.
I've been involved, as I said, I've participated in public disturbances. The trigger for me has been racists coming in and the police not stopping them, and then the police arresting us on a continuous basis. And
so the victim there's instead a time of the bomb perpetrators.
That comes. And when you are there, you realize the danger that exists. You realize the chaos that exists. You realize that you live in the area and you're breaking up a shop and that you're fighting with the police. You actually realize it's very conscious. It's not as if it's unconscious and there's got no reason to control. It's frightening. And it's only people who participate in it, who want to create a message, actually win the day. So you create those areas where the police can't enter for a specific period, for a specific reason. And that is to say that if we are not hurt, and if, after all, even according to, you know, the apostle of peace, Martin Luther King, riots are the voices of the unheard, which is actually what they are. Yes, you have sterile areas created by the police. In the same way, you have policing of what you call saturation policing, which they talk about in the earlier period, which is indiscriminate arrests at certain times to create fear in community.
It was Project Hammer, I think, they called it in the documentary, Operation Project Hammer.
Yeah, I mean, in this country, they call it saturation policing. Mm. And we've, in BRICS...
Well, we'll just pause there for now. John Ridley talking during an ABC radio interview with Amna Nawaz about the prospect of another uprising.
Worry there could be similar kinds of level of riots or uprisings and
absolutely
that, yeah.
You know, look, whether how the scope and scale, how big they are, how pervasive they are, you know, again, you know, Los Angeles is a city, how it was policed, and I don't even mean the psychology of it, just the numbers, the demographics, what the capacities were, it's very, very different. It was very, very singular. So I have no doubt in terms of interactions, in terms of what happens in communities, how we look at each other, you know, that we know. I mean, we just know that there are issues. Whether that results in a large-scale uprising, whether it results in a few individuals spilling out on the streets, mm-hmm. whether that is a public demonstration where police and citizenry are going out together to say, look, there's an issue and we got to deal with it, or whether it's just people who feel like they're fed up. You know, how it happens, what the results are, that I can't predict, but I'm absolutely sure that there are stress points, that there are people who feel like they're being marginalized, they're not being listened to somewhere right now, and they are going to want recourse. We need to make sure that that recourse is positive, it's real engagement, because otherwise, you know, when you take away people's voices, when you take away their ability to be heard, they will make themselves heard in any way that they feel is appropriate.
Lee, you were just saying earlier how much of an activist Ridley is. What did you make of his comments there in that radio interview?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important. You know, historically, he's done these, you know, he's had these moments where people have been very critical of what he's done. People change. And I think he would probably say that he's not the same filmmaker or maybe even person that he was when he did these other projects. And fair play to him. You know, if we're discussing this particular film, I think it's a really balanced, restrained, empathetic portrait that really tries to get to the, you know, the hub of a wide range of issues. So, you know, I can only kind of agree with everything he's saying. And it's also, I think the other thing is, we hear so much about this one time in LA. I would love to hear similar projects about other cities in the US and also in other countries. It's not just America that has systemic, you know, issues with its police force and racism stuff. It's happening all over the world. And it would be great if there were, you know, similar projects as detailed and nuanced that covered other areas. I know more about, you know, Rodney King and Latasha Harlins than I do about some of the, you know, the issues that have happened in this country simply because of the proliferation of documentaries and studies about this time. Mm-hmm. It's all important, mm-hmm. but I'd also like to see other areas and other countries covered in a similar way.
That's interesting. Of course, this year marks 25 years since the LA riots. Perhaps this is why all the emergence of these documentaries are coming out. But Suresh, I'd like to ask you, actually, what are some of the differences or similarities between the US and the UK when it comes to institutional police racism and how they treat black people?
Let's look at the similarities. I think the British police has been found to be institutional racism because of the McPherson inquiry in 1999. And there hasn't been enough work done by the police to show that they've actually dealt with it properly. You've seen in this country, just like America, although the proportion of killings in America is much, much, much greater. You have something like 16 deaths a day. Mm-hmm. You don't have the same frequency, but it's a smaller black population than America. The American population has been there longer. I think what you really have in similarity is the lack of accountability of the police force. The manner in which police always, almost get away with murder or police brutality. Nobody's actually held account in a public arena.
Of course, this is why what caused the riots, effectively the straw that broke the camel's back, was that there was videotape evidence of Rodney King's brutal beating.
I think what
and the police officers walked free.
Yeah, they walked free in Rodney King's case as far as the district court's concerned, but obviously, as you know, two people were convicted in the federal court in the subsequent trial.
Of course.
And there are important points to make on the judiciary as well in this trial.
The whole but criminal justice
so,
system.
The differences are that just the black American political process of being there for a long time, of developing resistance, black power politics, is much more deep-seated than in this country. But this country has this glass ceiling which does not see pivotal figures in the black community just as important as the black, as the Americans would do in terms of black. For example, people like Hugh Newton in the Black Power Movement. There are equivalents in this country. And just like this film, there's a film called Hard Stop on Totem Riots, which is a fascinating, film of the killing of Duggan told through the eyes of his two friends. It's a fascinating film. It could be much better if it was given more finances. Mm-hmm. So there are attempts being made. But I think this country neglects and actually does not acknowledge the skills that black communities have in their communities, young people, women and children.
So there's much work to be done, I suppose. And unfortunately, we're reaching the end of the program now. And Lee, just the final 30 seconds to you. Would you recommend this documentary?
I would. I think, I mean, I've seen quite a number of the recent films that either touch on this specific area or, you know, institutional racism. And I would say it's one of the more thorough and nuanced films. I would also recommend the Made in America film, which again covers similar things. But it really is, when people actually, it's proper journalism, and it's also good filmmaking, and when you put those together, you know, you really do allow viewers to get a better understanding, and then hopefully that's what you can build on to sort of, you know, change things in the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen, for coming on to Doc Review. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this episode. And that's it. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Shambayati.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.